Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm not Jessica Lilly. Nope, my name is Adam Harris. I'm the executive producer for Mountain Stage with Larry Gross here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. When Roxy and Jessica asked if I would help produce this week's show, I jumped at the chance to share a few of my favorite Inside Appalachia stories. I've had the great pleasure of working with the incredible musician Charlie McCoy on multiple occasions, so I wanted to revisit this story that Jessica and Roxy Todd did about the country music legend from Oak Hill, West Virginia.
Wow, I was a huge fan of Roy Orbison. And we did the record Candyman. That was my second session, was Candyman, and when it hit the radio, my phone started ringing.
One of my favorite foods is the delicious and distinctly West Virginian pepperoni roll.
This is where we bake the pepperoni buns in this oven here. The pepperoni buns and buns, and over there's the bread, cookies, pies.
And like many of you, I also have a sweet tooth for maple syrup.
And it came out of a tree. I mean, how much more naturally filtered can you get than that?
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome, you're Inside Appalachia. I'm Adam Harris, stepping in for Jessica Lilly. She'll be back next week. I'm the executive producer with West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Mountain Stage with Larry Gross, but I'm also a longtime fan of Inside Appalachia. You may have heard me talking about independent wrestling on a recent episode, which you can hear in our archives. I'm excited that Jessica Lilly and the rest of the gang at Inside Appalachia asked me to share some of my favorite stories with you, and I hope you'll enjoy them too. Pepperoni rolls have been called the unofficial food of West Virginia. They were invented here in the Mountain State, and legend has it that they were originally made for coal miners to take underground in their dinner buckets, because the cured meat wouldn't spoil. In 2015, Roxy Todd visited the bakery that's credited with having invented the pepperoni roll. Here's a taste of her visit.
Even before you walk through the front door, the smells are pretty enticing. Fresh pepperoni baked into white Italian bread, mixed with the sweetness of fresh chocolate cookies, all cooling on the racks. That's what greets you as you walk inside. A big glass counter full of pepperoni rolls fills the room.
Who do you see come in to get pepperoni rolls?
All different types of people from all different states.
That's Marge Jarrett behind the counter.
I just had people just left here that never had them before come back in and got more.
Beside Marge, pepperoni rolls are on display behind glass. Behind that are shelves of cookies, all fresh out of the oven. On the wall are framed newspaper clippings that tell history of the first pepperoni rolls, which date back to the late 20s or early 30s. The first owner of this bakery supposedly invented them and sold them to coal miners.
Miners took bread and pepperoni, and then they'd bite pepperoni, take a bite of bread, and so he decided to do pepperoni rolls.
Pat Carr and his brother Larry walk in the door. Pat still lives here in Fairmont, but Larry is visiting from California, and he just had to make a stop on his way to the airport to buy 2 dozen pepperoni rolls.
Looking forward to getting these home and put some sauce and cheese on them and throw them in the oven, and they'll be perfect. It's the only place you can get them is right here, and these are the best.
Larry remembers smelling these pepperoni rolls baking even from the road.
Every time you drive by here, you could smell them, and that just drew you right into the parking lot. I remember that as a child, driving by here. The windows were open, and you could smell the fresh pepperoni buns coming out of the oven.
His brother Pat says the simple, Spartan look to this bakery is part of its charm.
When Larry and I were a kid, came here, and I was just telling Larry when we got out of the car, I said it looks exactly the same, but it's well kept. It's a neat place.
But the most important thing about pepperoni rolls, according to the Carr brothers, is this. Again, here's Larry.
I mean, there are several people that make pepperoni rolls, but most of them don't use the sticks like you use here. They use slices of pepperoni, and I think the sticks are much better.
Most of the pepperoni rolls that are sold at gas stations and in supermarkets, those all pretty much use round, flat slices of pepperoni. The doors of the Country Club bakery seem to revolve with a constant flow of pepperoni roll customers. Janet Living grew up in nearby Ida May, one of the former coal camps in Marion County.
I've been eating them for like probably 60-some years, and so I love them. This bakery's been here for a lot of years, and it's very special.
The dough for the pepperoni rolls was all mixed early this morning and set to rise. The head baker, Misty Whiteman, begins the process at 2 o'clock in the morning.
I eat them, not a lot, But when they smell really good coming out of the oven, yes, they do starve me to death.
But Misty's favorite way to eat the pepperoni rolls?
I like them with a garden tomato on them and Miracle Whip. Yeah.
Misty doesn't look like someone who's been stuffing herself with pepperoni rolls. She's small but strong. She's been working here for 34 years, and she insists on doing all the heavy lifting of the flour sacks herself.
Well, you get used to it after a while. You do it every day, every day, every day, every day, yes. Yeah. They always say, you ought to get them boys to do it. And I said, nope. Them boys ain't here. Who's going to do it? So, and if I'm not built up to do it, then I can't do it. You don't get bored. Right now, and it's very, very busy with the heat and the humidity. You're lucky that you get to turn around and sit down maybe 5 minutes.
Back near the ovens, it is very hot. Misty's used to it, but I'm sweating.
This is where we bake the pepperoni buns in this oven here. The pepperoni buns and buns, and over there's the bread, cookies, pies. It's in that one.
And when the pepperoni rolls are baking at 500 degrees, Misty says it probably gets well over 100 degrees in this room. She doesn't know exactly because the thermometers max out at 105 degrees. The Country Club Bakery is very small. It feels like a real kitchen in somebody's home. Someone comes in every day to cut the pepperoni by hand, and the machine they use overlooks a green lawn. Light from the huge windows shines everywhere. Misty agrees with the customers we heard from earlier. She doesn't like those pepperoni rolls that come from convenience stores because they don't even compare to one of these warm pepperoni rolls right out of the oven.
Very good. Yeah, way different. They're a lot better. Fresh.
Misty is one of about 10 employees here. Together, they bake about 300 dozen pepperoni rolls a day, all right here in this one oven.
Isn't that awesome? Yeah. I can get 20 pans in that oven. 45 dozen.
And like when pepperoni rolls were first invented, they're often eaten as a meal unto themselves by lots of people here in West Virginia.
And then when the summertime, when it's real hot, everybody gets pepperoni buns because you don't have to cook them. They're all done. Make a sandwich. I mean, it's a good meal.
That was Misty Whiteman, who bakes pepperoni rolls at the Country Club Bakery in Fairmont. Needless to say, Roxy didn't leave the bakery without buying a few pepperoni rolls that day. So I'd like to know, what's your favorite way to eat pepperoni rolls? Or if you've moved away, what do you do to satisfy your pepperoni roll cravings? Tell us your story on Twitter at InAppalachia. There's even a book about pepperoni rolls. To learn more, Roxy Todd had a chat with Candace Nelson, the author of The West Virginia Pepperoni Roll.
Tell me about your first experience and memory with pepperoni rolls.
Sure. I mean, my first experience with the pepperoni roll goes way back. I remember, especially in high school, we actually had them as fundraisers. So our marching band would sell them, and we'd run out at lunchtime to go buy a pepperoni roll for lunch instead of whatever the cafeteria may have been serving. And that was pretty common to me. And I didn't realize that pepperoni rolls were unique to West Virginia until I actually moved to Morgantown and met folks who are from, you know, states surrounding West Virginia. And they had never heard of a pepperoni roll. And my first question was, well, what did you sell for fundraisers in high school? And of course, they thought that was silly. There's a lot of other things that you can sell. But it was just so part of my experience that I didn't even entertain the thought that others didn't share that. So high school is when I really participated in the whole pepperoni roll sale, because they were larger than the traditional pepperoni roll. They were a whole meal. And they had sauce and sliced pepperoni, which I know is sacrilege in some parts of the state. But they were great, you know, filled with warm cheese, and they really constituted an entire meal, whereas some of the more traditional ones are smaller and more of a snack.
So do you share those with somebody else, or you eat it all to yourself?
So we're probably supposed to share them with someone else. I'm not sure that I did that, because I remember them being, and they, I think maybe still to this day, they might be my favorite ones. But it was definitely one of my fun memories from high school, rushing out of our second or third class for the day and trying to get in line so you could get yours first. But yeah, I think those still remain probably my favorite pepperoni rolls.
It sounds delicious. I need to try one of those. So tell me, As you started researching this book and talking to people about their memories of the pepperoni roll, what are some of the stories you have been hearing?
Oh, goodness. There are so many good stories. And I think the thing that's really cool about the pepperoni roll is that it's more than just a food to so many people. It's what they associate with tailgating for their first, you know, football games, or the snacks that they had at picnics or school trips, or it's really much more than just this food. It's more tied to their memory, which is pretty cool.
And I know it's kind of ambiguous who invented the pepperoni roll. It's kind of this question that's unanswerable in some ways. What did you find out when you asked people who invented the pepperoni roll?
So the creation of the pepperoni roll is as much utilitarian as it is culinary. And Chris Pallotta, the current owner of Country Club Bakery, which is the one that's widely credited with the invention of the pepperoni roll, said that Giuseppe Argiro, who emigrated from Calabria, Italy, to work in the coal mines in north central West Virginia, was looking for an easier way to eat lunch in the mines. And he knew his fellow Italians would often bring water and a stick of pepperoni or salami and a roll for lunch. So what Giuseppe did sometime around 1927 was combine the pepperoni and the bread into the pepperoni roll so you can eat it with one hand and drink with the other. So the pepperoni roll really became this kind of portable, cheap, non-perishable lunch. And it's likely that someone somewhere, maybe even into Western PA, may have made this in a home kitchen somewhere. We don't know that for sure. But we do know that Giuseppe is the one who's credited with commercializing it, and that's how it helped take off.
And we've been hearing on our show today a lot about the food that miners would take down into the mines and the food that their wives would pack for them often. And, you know, it seems that the pepperoni rolls ties right into that. This is food that was utilitarian, as you say, food that wouldn't go bad on a long shift down in the mines. It's interesting to me that probably, in my mind, wives or women maybe invented this just to give to their husbands. But like many things, men kind of commercialized it.
I think that's very likely the case. We know that Giuseppe commercialized it. But if we think back to who was actually packing those lunches at that point in time, it was definitely the wives. The men were going down into these mines and working very long days. And to have something that is simple and non-perishable, and it's easier and quicker for them to eat so they can get back to work. You know, they're trying to make life a little bit easier and make something that's this one-handed lunch where they can drink in one hand, eat in the other, and get back to work.
And when we talk about pepperoni rolls and I explain it to people for the first time, sometimes people say, I don't get it. It's a stick of pepperoni. It's some white bread. What's the big deal? There's a lot of nostalgia and, you know, like childhood memories wrapped into it. But just in a culinary way, there's something magical that happens when the grease of the pepperoni gets into the bread. And it's just, it's indescribable what the magic is. How do you describe why it's so popular in West Virginia?
I think part of the reason for the pepperoni roll's popularity is that it's this really homegrown meal for us here in the state. We don't have a lot of meals that we've actually created here. We have a lot of meals that, you know, we're known for or are our favorites. But as far as the pepperoni roll goes, we actually made this here. And I think we take a lot of pride in that. It's pretty simple. Like you said, there's the dough, there's the pepperoni. But I know that the folks down at Abruzzino's in Gypsy, West Virginia, he mentioned how customers will come in and actually turn over the bags of pepperoni rolls to see which one has that kind of orangish grease that has kind of seeped out, that those spices and the oils from the pepperoni kind of consume the bread and make it this really tasty snack. I think when a lot of people think that it's just dough and pepperoni, you're not giving as much credit, because you have to think when it, there's something special that happens when it goes in the oven and the pepperoni emits those spices and those herbs and those oils, and it infuses with the dough to create something that's really, really delicious.
When you were doing this research, did you talk to people who have moved out of the state who just long for pepperoni rolls, who beg? You know, there's all these groups of people that ask their relatives to mail them pepperoni rolls.
I have. That's actually a big part of the book. There are a few people who have craved pepperoni rolls so much that they've created their own recipe to sort of mimic their favorites from back home. So there are West Virginians out in the Pacific Northwest, Tennessee. I have folks from all over who have a recipe that they've either tried to recreate from their favorite bakery, or it might even be something that has been passed down through their family. I know folks who have had them at their weddings. I know that's been important. You know, it really is just a part of the culture, and I think it's so representative of who we are as West Virginians to have this sort of homegrown snack that we're proud of, that was created here, that is born from the coal mines, just as our history is. And it's something that we take great pride in.
Next, I want to share with you a little personal memory. I called my mom to talk to her about how she makes pepperoni rolls. My mother's fresh-baked rolls were always a staple at any of our family gatherings, and I got to thinking that her pepperoni rolls must have been the first that I ever had.
Somebody asked me today when I first had a pepperoni roll.
And
And I know it would have been one of yours, and so I wanted to ask you where you would have heard or had your first pepperoni roll, and then why did you decide to make them at home?
It was just the idea I came up with. I thought, well, if you can buy them, you can make them.
Well, you were famous for your roll recipe.
Yeah.
You were making those before you were making pepperoni rolls, right?
Right. And, of course, I use my own roll dough. Everybody's roll dough is different, and I don't have a recipe for it. I just throw it all together.
So what would you put in them?
Three pieces of pepperoni, and I put one, well, I take one piece of pepperoni and put a hunk of cheddar cheese and then two pieces of pepperoni on top of that and wrap them in my roll dough.
And bake them for how long?
Oh, dear. I think it's 12 minutes.
Okay. So do you think the first pepperoni roll you would have eaten would have been one that you made?
Yeah, probably so. And I can't even remember when I started making them. Yeah. And we used to dip them in spaghetti sauce. Do you remember that?
Well, that's what...
Or just eating them plain while they're hot.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they're better hot.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I didn't... That's one of the debates, is if you serve them with marinara or whatever or not, you know, and does it have cheese or not, or, you know, some people put hot cheese, some people, you know...
Right, and some people don't put any cheese at all.
Right. What do you think about stick pepperoni?
I've never made them with the stick pepperoni.
That's what I thought.
You're about the first survey person this evening on this phone. For old surveys and for presidents and this, that, and the other, you know.
So, am I the first survey you decided to do?
Yeah. The rest of them I hung up on.
Well, good. Well, at least we got to talk about a matter that's important.
Exactly.
Do you want to say anything else about pepperoni rolls?
No, nothing other than I know all my family likes them, right?
That's right. We all do.
And I like them best when they're hot.
Are you craving pepperoni rolls now?
Yes.
All right. Well, I'll let you go.
Okay.
All
love
right.
you.
I love you too, Mom.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's one of the best parts of this job, getting to talk to your mom about some family memories. I'm Adam Harris, the producer of Mountain Stage, and I'm stepping in for Jessica Lilly, playing some of my favorite Inside Appalachia stories. I'm really glad you could join us. As you can imagine, music is a big part of my life. So my next favorite story to share with you today is about a man who left his home in Fayette County, West Virginia, to work in the Nashville music industry for more than 5 decades, Charlie McCoy. If you've listened to just about any album recorded in Nashville in the 1960s and 70s, chances are then you've heard Charlie McCoy. Jessica Lilly and Roxy Todd produced this story, and it starts out with Charlie talking about some of his favorite music. He played as a session musician for recording greats like Roy Orbison.
Wow, I was a huge fan of Roy Orbison. And we did the record Candyman. That was my second session, was Candyman. And when it hit the radio, my phone started ringing.
Yeah, come on, baby. Let me take you by the hand.
And Elvis Presley.
Elvis would sleep all day, and he wouldn't record until the night. They would bring in food at midnight, and one night we were in the line to get, they had burgers and fries, and the drummer named Jerry Kerrigan was, and there was a big milkshake cup full of dill pickle spears, and he reaches in to pull one of them out, and this hand out of nowhere grabs his wrist and said, "Those are Elvis's pickles." One of the Memphis Mafia.
Charlie McCoy also recorded albums with country greats like Loretta Lynn.
Ah, Loretta was so great. My favorite record that I played on with her was a ballad called When the Tingle Becomes a Chill.
Sometime at night, while you're fast asleep, I lie here alone in the darkness.
And he helped write one of George Jones's greatest hits, He Stopped Loving Her Today.
He stopped loving her today. It placed a wreath upon his door, and soon they'll carry him away.
Charlie McCoy has a new book out about his life journey. His memoir is called 50 Cents in a Box Top. So where did the title come from? Roxy Todd explains.
Charlie McCoy was born in Oak Hill, West Virginia, the same town where they found the body of Hank Williams. Charlie was 8 years old when he got his first harmonica, the instrument that would later launch his career as a session musician in Nashville.
I saw an ad in a comic book. You can play harmonica in 7 days or your money back. Send 50 cents and a box top. And so I conned my mom out of 50 cents. You know, she was a single mom. In 1949, 50 cents was some money. It would buy something. But she bought this for me, and felt like forever before it finally came. But when it did, after about a day, she said, "Could you take it outside?" You know, an 8-year-old kid with a harmonica doesn't have a clue what he's doing, and I'm just making noise. And that's when I discovered that dogs and cats don't really care for harmonicas. All the neighborhood animals would protest as well.
He put that harmonica away for a few years. After all, he was more excited about playing baseball and guitar. But when he was in high school, he remembered his old harmonica again when he heard blues harmonica player Jimmy Reed playing on the radio.
The harmonica was so haunting the way he did it. Of course, I was a child of the 50s, you know, and rock and roll hit the radio like a storm, you know. And one day while surfing the radio dial, I ran into a rhythm and blues station and I heard a record by Jimmy Reed. And when I heard that record with that harmonica, it hit me in the head. Hey, I got one of those. I need to learn to do that. So then I got reinterested in the harmonica in a big way.
By this time, Charlie had moved to Miami, Florida with his dad, who bought him an electric guitar and got him music lessons. In the Miami public schools, his music teachers recognized he had a special gift for learning music by ear.
The school system in Florida, they decided to experiment with music theory in the high school. It was classical theory, and the teacher, she was expert and knew how to teach it, and I was like a sponge. I couldn't get enough of it.
Then Charlie met a Nashville songwriter named Mel Tillis, who promised to help him get a contract with a record company if he ever made his way to Nashville.
That was like showing a steak to a wolf. And so the day after high school, I went to Nashville, and I went to the office of his manager, and they said, "Well, Mel's out of town."
But the publisher got Charlie an audition with Chet Atkins and Owen Bradley, who at that time were two of the major producers in Nashville.
And both of those guys turned Charlie down.
That's Travis Steimling, a music historian who co-wrote Charlie McCoy's book. Like Charlie, he's a West Virginia native.
He now teaches at West Virginia University and directs the school's bluegrass band. And he's been a big fan of Charlie McCoy since he was a little kid, when he spent most Saturday nights watching Hee Haw. Charlie played on the show for 18 years and was the music director for most of them.
I remember during the summer especially, you know, we'd work in the garden late into the evening. Saturday nights, we would get a chance to go down to the house early, get a bath, and watch Hee Haw at 7 o'clock. And Charlie was the band leader on that. So I remember, you know, watching the opening credits, Charlie McCoy and the Hee Haw Band. And here's this guy in the back, you know, playing harmonica with everybody. And I thought, that guy's pretty cool. You know, I bet, you know, he must be a really great musician if everybody wants to play with him. And, you know, the more research I did, you know, as an adult, you know, fast forward 20 years or better, I realized that he really did play with everybody. You know, the reason he could play on Hee Haw with all of these great musicians is that he had recorded with them originally. He knew their work because he was one of the people who helped to make it.
And it all started that day in 1959 when 18-year-old Charlie was rejected by the two big recording producers in Nashville.
And of course, the best thing they did for me was turn me down as a singer.
But one of the producers invited him to see a recording session at his studio. 13-year-old Brenda Lee was recording this song called Sweet Nothings.
All right. My baby whispers in my ear.
And he gets to see Brenda Lee recording with a group of musicians that we call the Nashville A-Team. And it was there that he decided, this is so cool, I want to do it the rest of my life.
And when I watched that session and watched those musicians and then heard that first playback, at that moment I said, hey, I don't want to be a singer, I want to do this. That was my goal then, be a studio musician.
In just a minute, we'll hear how Charlie McCoy got to play with Bob Dylan, Roy Orbison, and Johnny Cash.
Everybody and their brother is coming through Nashville trying to play some sort of country music to get back in touch to sort of a kind of a rootsier, kind of more grounded American sound. And Charlie was right there at the center of all of that.
That's coming up after the break. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Let's return to the story of Charlie McCoy, a native of Fayette County, West Virginia, who moved to Nashville, Tennessee in 1960. Roxy Todd takes us back to his journey at the time when Nashville's recording industry was just about to explode. After he saw his first recording session in Nashville, Charlie McCoy was certain that's what he wanted to do. But his dad insisted he go to college. He was about to start his freshman year at the University of Miami as a music major. So he went back to Florida.
Yes, I had a teacher, a 70-year-old lady from France. Her name was Madame Renée Langer. She had taught the great Leonard Bernstein. And she was incredible. It was, the technical name of the class was solfeggio, which is Italian. It means sight reading and ear training. And man, I'll tell you, when I came out of that class, I think I could write down a bird on a telephone wire. I mean, it was that intense. And that class would serve me well for the rest of my career.
Langer was actually a pretty supportive teacher in a lot of ways.
Again, this is music historian Travis Steimling.
She was the one who said, hey, Charlie, if you want to do country music, you want to do rock and roll, go do it. Go make your own music. You don't have to do this conservatory thing.
Around this time, Charlie got a call from a friend who wanted him to join their Nashville-based band called Stonewall Jackson.
Ooh, that was tempting. So I thought about it, and finally decided one day, I got to do this. So I drummed up enough courage to break my father's heart and took off to Nashville. And when I got here, we went to the first rehearsal, and the guy said, "Oh, we'd already hired somebody." "Thanks a lot." And he said, "But can you play anything else?" I said, "Yeah, I play harmonica." He said, "No, can you play drums?" And I thought, say no and you're done. Say yes and figure it out. So I said, "Yes, but I don't have any." He said, "We'll get you some." So my first job in Nashville was as a drummer.
Then in 1961, Charlie McCoy was asked to record harmonica on a song called "I Just Don't Understand." Anne Margaret was the singer.
Bombshell Beauty from Sweden, who's there for her first Nashville recording session. And the song's called "I Just Don't Understand." That showed Charlie off as kind of a blues harmonica player. And so that was really his first break as a session player.
"Well, you call me your baby when you hold me."
From 1962 on, Charlie had fairly steady session work, playing with Roy Orbison, Elvis, and Bob Dylan. He helped record three albums with Dylan, starting with Blonde on Blonde, an album that Travis Steinling researched while helping Charlie write his book.
So I went to New York and visited Bob Dylan's offices, and they let me listen to all of the outtakes from those sessions. And, you know, there are moments where it's clear Dylan doesn't know what he wants. You know, it doesn't know in terms of musical feel or the structure of the song, and maybe even in some cases the lyrics haven't been fully worked out. And there's Charlie quietly, kind of politely and politically trying to steer all of the musicians and steering Dylan toward something that would be a great product. And so that album, Blonde on Blonde, is considered a landmark album now, but it wouldn't have happened without Charlie.
Blonde on Blonde was an album that changed Nashville forever, because after that album was released, all of the folk rock artists wanted to record here. It was like Bob Dylan put his stamp of approval on Nashville. And boy, the floodgates did open.
In sessions, Charlie's musical theory training from high school and college helped him learn songs quickly and figure out intuitively how to create musical arrangements on the spot. He could also play multiple instruments, even playing the trumpet and the tuba at the same time. Another trick with two harmonicas impressed Johnny Cash.
Probably the song that Charlie's best known for with Johnny Cash is a song called The Orange Blossom Special, which of course is an old fiddle tune from Florida. And so Charlie figures out a system to play the song using two different harmonicas, and he kind of swaps back and forth between them. And that's what he recorded with Cash. At the end of the session, Cash says, "Hey, could you teach me how to do that?" And Charlie says, "Well, I can do you one better. Here are the two harmonicas I use. They're yours now."
"Look yonder coming down that railroad track. Hey, look yonder coming."
And so you really can't go very deep into the American popular music landscape of the last 50 years without finding Charlie. I mean, he's everywhere. And so we play a game in my house called "Can You Spot Charlie?" We'll be listening to one of the classic country stations on satellite or something, and we'll have to, I'll make everybody in the car guess what instrument's Charlie playing now. And, you know, when he's playing harmonica, that's easy. But when he's playing bass, that's another story altogether. I mean, he's just everywhere. And the thing is, he's been able to work for 56 years as a consequence of that. If he were just a harmonica player, not so sure that that would have worked out.
Meanwhile, apart from his session work, Charlie McCoy also played on the show Hee Haw. You know the one, with Minnie Pearl and Roy Clark. Most of the actors and musicians wore overalls, and there were usually cornfields and hay bales somewhere in the set.
So I decided to try it for one season. Well, you know, it ended up 18 seasons I kept trying it.
The show ran from 1969 to 1991. After it was canceled, Charlie kept on with session work. He also recorded 40 solo albums and has regularly toured across the United States, Europe, and Japan. He was inducted into the West Virginia Hall of Fame in 2008 and into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 2009. Even though he's quick to point out that back in 1960, he was a college dropout, he was given an honorary doctorate of music from West Virginia University last year.
Well, it's tall corn for a kid from Fayette County, I can tell you that.
And even though he spent a lot of his teenage years in Florida and most of his adulthood in Nashville, Charlie still calls himself a West Virginian.
Yeah, I'm really proud. My brother still lives in Fayetteville, and we did 18 years of concerts in Fayetteville raising money for the town park. And I'm proud to have the park with my name on it. And I love to go back there. It wasn't until I moved away that I realized how beautiful it is. And I would so look forward to coming back. I mean, I was asked to play the national anthem for the dedication of the New River Gorge Bridge. That gorge right there with a bridge, I mean, that's just one of the most beautiful spots I've ever seen.
At 76, Charlie McCoy still keeps busy recording music and touring. When I spoke with him, he was heading out the door for a tour in Sweden. He says he doesn't plan on slowing down anytime soon. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd. Let me take you by the hand. Come on, sugar.
Let me take you by the hand. I just love hearing those stories from Charlie, and I love hearing him play. Charlie has been a part of the band at the induction ceremonies for the West Virginia Music Hall of Fame over the years, and he was rightfully inducted himself in 2008. It's always a thrill to watch Charlie work amongst a group of musicians. He's such a professional, and I've never seen him flustered. He can solve a musical problem in an instant, and while he takes the music seriously, he'll never miss a chance to tell a good joke or get a laugh out of his comrades while he's on stage. I remember at one Hall of Fame rehearsal, Charlie and the band were about to back Kathy Mattea on her performance, and as Kathy was putting on her guitar, Charlie turned to her, and in a voice loud enough for everybody to hear, he said, "Kathy, are you going to tune that thing or just play regular?" That's some prime musician humor right there. Here's another of my favorite Inside Appalachia stories. This one involves tent revivals and the upbeat, high-energy gospel hymns that inspired many American rock and roll artists. To document some of the remaining services, Roger May started a project called Glory a few years ago. On May's personal website, rogermayphotography.com, one photograph shows a woman standing under a tent, surrounded by women, with arms outstretched, while a man in a black suit has his hands on the woman's forehead. Another photograph shows a handmade sign that reads, "Tent Revival, 7 p.m., sitting in front of a large bush. The photos are from tent revivals in eastern Kentucky and southern West Virginia. May sat down with our host, Jessica Lilly, to talk about the photos.
I'm familiar with, you know, Pentecostal holiness movement, and grew up in a Free Will Baptist church, and have seen all manner of faith practices practiced here in the mountains. But I don't know that I'd ever been to a tent revival. I'd driven by and seen them before, but don't know that I'd ever been to one. And so when I pulled up in the parking lot, they had already started singing and playing music. And I sat there for a few minutes, and I watched a guy get up from under the tent and walk out and walk toward me. He introduced himself and asked me to come in and be a part of the service. And I said, "Well, I'm a photographer, and you know, I've always wanted to photograph a tent revival. Would it be okay if maybe I made some pictures?" And he kind of patted me on the arm and said, "Honey, you can take pictures of anything you want to, and if anybody has a problem with it, you just tell them to come see me." And I didn't know it at the time, but he was the preacher, and so I kind of felt like, you know, if he was giving me the green light to be there, then that was okay.
So you said you're familiar with sort of a Pentecostal type religion in growing up, but you had never been to a tent revival. What have you learned about tent revivals?
I guess the takeaway for me has been just the persistence and the sheer faith of these folks, because there's nothing glorious about what they do. I mean, they're faithful servants. I mean, they Brother Roger stays in a camper with his family, and there's no air conditioning. It's the summertime, and he's out for hours each evening preaching his sermon to an audience of, you know, maybe three people one night, maybe 30 people the next night. So I think there's something to be said about perseverance and being faithful to what you feel like you're called to do.
How important is it, do you think, to photograph tent revivals as far as depicting a part of Appalachia?
Well, for me, it's super important to me because I think it's something that's slowly dying off. It's a tradition that we don't see much of. You know, I was talking not long ago with someone about foot washing, you know, and I grew up in a church that, you know, they would wash feet, you know, on a fairly regular basis. And I think about those traditions that I know are still practiced, but they're maybe not known much outside of the region. And so I think tent revivals fall into that category of something that could be celebrated and should be preserved and shown in a way that that sort of embodies the dignity and respect that it deserves.
Why do you think that they have lasted as long as they have here?
I think it's the people. People like to gather, the element of faith. People gather around faith. There's an aspect of community that I've seen in West Virginia and Kentucky that I've never seen anywhere else. You know, there's that whole saying that, you know, you never meet a stranger, you know, and that's what I think about when I pulled into that parking lot and Brother Roger got up from under the tent and came out. I mean, as soon as I pulled up, he came out to meet me. And I don't know that I've been to too many other places that I can say somebody would do that.
But I think they might do that at like a beer fest too. Like they might come and greet you at that too. Do you think there's anything unique about the tent revivals or the people here that makes tent revivals last longer?
Faith. I mean, there's pretty strong faith, element of faith and kind of walking out what it is that you feel called to do, I think is what was, you know, happening in that situation when he got up and came to my car and invited me in. I think that level of persistence and that commitment to faith is what drew him out to do that. And that's, I've got to believe that that's an underlying theme of why he's still, you know, doing tent revivals, you know, and people like to be a part of something bigger than themselves, you know, and whatever that is, whether it's faith or whether it's sports or, you know, this Looking at Appalachia project, I think, and you know, we've had some success with that because people see that it's a community.
That was photographer Roger May talking with Jessica Lilly about the photos he's taken of tent revivals in central Appalachia. Roger May is the director of the project called Looking at Appalachia. When that conversation was originally recorded back in 2017, May was also the director of the Appalachian Southern Folklife Center in Pipestem, West Virginia. He now lives in Charleston. You can find more about his projects on our website at wvpublic.org. I want to share stories with you on one more topic. This is another one near and dear to my taste buds, maple syrup. In this first story, reporter Chris Williams introduces us to a producer who has been making maple syrup for nearly 30 years, and he just happens to be a neighbor of ours on my family's farm where we used to make maple syrup.
Brandon Daniels is a busy man. He works two jobs and is also responsible for 2,300 maple taps.
It's extremely hard work. You can't choose when the sap runs. You can choose when you cut your hay, but you can't choose when the sap runs.
Brandon has been making maple syrup in Greenbrier County for 28 years and makes around 600 to 800 gallons every year. But when he first started, he wasn't as successful.
Maybe a couple gallons with what we did in scorch and ruin.
He says technology has played a huge part in how he and other syrup producers in West Virginia make their product.
Reverse osmosis makes a huge difference. We can take out about 85 to 90% of the water before we boil it without affecting any of the flavor at all.
After the water is taken out, the remaining sap is boiled down and turned into the brown liquid called maple syrup, which is quite different from the syrup you buy in the store.
They're getting corn syrup, so it's just fructose, and it will run your blood sugar up very fast. Your body processes it very fast. It's not really, you know, anything as far as any natural minerals or anything in it.
Another advance in technology is tubing. Back in the day, maple syrup producers would hang buckets underneath the spouts. They would wait for the buckets to fill up and then carry them down to their sugar shack. The tubing connects all the trees and uses gravity to bring the sap into one big tank. The new technology and the vast amount of maple trees are causing a resurgence of maple syrup producers in the Mountain State.
You know, it's the first agriculture crop of the year.
And making the product is no easy task. To make 1 gallon of maple syrup takes anywhere between 50 to 75 gallons of sap. With more than 2,000 taps, Brandon's maple syrup production is one of the largest in West Virginia. Neither he nor anyone else in West Virginia is getting rich by making syrup.
If you had probably in the neighborhood of 10,000 taps and, you know, and you didn't have, you know, you tried to, you did most of it yourself without hiring out a lot of help, you could probably make a living doing it. Many years ago, there was a lot of people in West Virginia that did it. They would do it just, most of them just made enough for themselves. You know, it was a, it's kind of a sustenance. It was their sweetener and stuff. And so a lot of people made it. And it's kind of went by the wayside, but we have seen a resurgence.
The maple season lasts just 2.5 months at best. It all depends on the weather.
We like to have the freezing nights and the thawing days.
When the temperature drops below freezing, the maple trees pull the sap out of the roots. And when the temperature warms back up, the sap starts running through the tubing lines.
I mean, ideally, if you can get it down to 20s, you know, the mid low to mid-20s at night and the 40s during the day, that's ideal.
But with technology, Brandon says maple syrup production is growing in West Virginia. According to the State Department of Agriculture's most recent maple survey, there are more than 61,000 maple trees tapped in the Mountain State. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Chris Williams in Greenbrier County, West Virginia.
Just like that wonderful syrup itself, I can't get enough of talking about maple syrup, so I want to introduce you to Jeremy Ray. Here's a story by Jennifer Smith about an Iraq war veteran who is finding a way to his own peace using maple syrup.
Jeremy Ray is the proud owner of Gully River Maple. It's the first season for his new venture. He heard about maple syrup through the West Virginia Department of Agriculture's Veterans and Warriors to Agriculture program, aimed at retraining veterans for careers in agriculture. He took one maple syrup producer's class, taught in part by Brandon Daniels, and was hooked.
It's been a long time since I've been excited about anything.
Jeremy's property in Nicholas County is dotted with bright orange ribbons.
My youngest son, that's how he learned to tie his shoes this fall, was he went with me, and every time we identified a tree, he was the one that tied the ribbon on it.
He tapped one of those maple trees early this season and was rewarded with a sweet taste of things to come.
And it came out of the tree. I mean, how much more naturally filtered can you get than that?
You couldn't find anyone more surprised about this venture than Jeremy himself. The 43-year-old grew up on this land, but joined the Army National Guard right out of high school. He was looking for adventure, but then came the war in Iraq, and he was deployed overseas.
The day I deployed was the day my oldest son was born, so I was with him 24 hours and then wasn't back until he was 17 months old.
Jeremy doesn't talk much about what happened in Iraq and the things he saw, only that it changed him.
10 days after I got back home, I just went to work. I went back to the Sheriff's Department and tried not to think about it.
He worked for 14 years as a Nicholas County Sheriff's Deputy, all the while suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. He managed the depression, flashbacks, and anger, or so he thought, until the day his boss called him in the office in 2011 and told him to hand in his badge. When he went home to tell his wife, she too had had enough and walked out with their two sons.
I lost everything I'd ever worked for on November 11th, 2011, Veterans Day.
It took years of intense therapy and a lot of self-reflection, but Jeremy and his family reunited. Now on medical disability, he's looking for a new normal. That's where maple syrup comes in.
I'm a disabled veteran, and I needed something to take my time. I needed to get my mind busy on something, and I also wanted to find something that where my kids could help and enjoy it so we could get more time together.
His new workplace is far from the office atmosphere that triggered his anxieties. Outside with his maple trees, there's a sense of peace.
I'm by myself and in the woods. It's really relaxing.
West Virginia Commissioner of Agriculture Kent Leonhard, a veteran himself, says Jeremy's story is not uncommon.
When you think about what the unseen wounds of war do to our veterans, and what agriculture can do to help them heal. Veterans with that affliction. They don't want to be in an office. They don't want to have windows and doors and be around a lot of people. They want to be outside, which is why our beekeepers do so well with it. It's why maple syrup is an ideal therapy.
Jeremy might be a maple novice, but he's spreading the word.
Maple, it's nobody around here really knows about it, but everybody around here could do it if they wanted to. You know, in West Virginia, there's, you know, untapped potential everywhere. If a crazy disabled vet can do it, anybody can.
Including Jeremy's six-year-old son, Jackson, who tags along with his dad every chance he gets. Jeremy says one day, Gully River maple will belong to Jackson and his older brother, a legacy of love born from the wounds of war. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Jennifer Smith in Nicholas County, West Virginia.
I love the imagery in that story. It reminds me of my family's farm in Grassy Meadows, West Virginia, where my dad, uncle, and family friend would boil sap for syrup for many years. The next time you enjoy some local maple syrup, I hope you'll think about all the time and attention that goes into the process. My father, a lifelong farmer, used to say that he finally found something that was more work than cattle farming, but paid less. All that work was worth it when the season ended and we had all that syrup. I'd like to thank Jessica Lilly for letting me take the wheel this week and put together an Inside Appalachia show with some of my favorite stories from the past couple years. Appalachia has so many great things to be proud of, from our food to our music to our people. I'm sure I could do another 10 episodes of favorites, but I need to step aside and let the Inside Appalachia team tell more of those stories so I can have some more favorites in the future. Jessica Lilly will be back next week. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Adam Harris. Thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Roxy Todd, Jessica Lilly, Chris Williams, and Jennifer Smith. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Charlie McCoy, and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright, and he also edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Molly Bourne is our web editor, and you can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia to West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. And if you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget you can subscribe or download all of our stories on Apple Podcasts, wvpublic.org, or wherever it is you listen. I'm Adam Harris. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, helping West Virginia farmers markets provide food harvested that morning and brought to you fresh from the farm. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.